Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info.
Hank Schrevel, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And so you've got quite the history before you got into writing. So you were with the Air Force and how did you get into the whole military thing and that part of your life?
Well, I needed a job. So when I was in college, I was majoring in political science, and that interested me. And I realized early on that there was not a whole lot of opportunity in the private sector for political scientists. But it did seem a good pre-law major, which is something I definitely had been thinking of, but didn't have a whole lot of money. So I thought, you know, I probably should work a little bit and try to get my legs under me financially. And the military looked like a good opportunity to get some training and some, you know, credibility and some experience and some money, and possibly take advantage of some education programs they had. I went in to ROTC, you know, an ROTC scholarship, and then went in the military, and then I went to law school after I did a few years in the military.
Yeah, but with, you know, so it sounds like you've had quite the career in that. It was pretty interesting.
It was interesting, yes. It was interesting.
Why did you leave it? Like, as in, now you're kind of venturing into writing, and you've done well. I mean, I guess you're first novel, you did win the Bram Stoker Award for best first novel.
So
you've jumped into this and you've done more since, and you've got more coming, but what initiated that change or got you to do actually that first book?
Well, I always really had a strong interest in writing. I did not have a strong interest in being a starving artist though. And so while it was always something that I had as a goal, you know, in the fore of my mind, it was not something I really thought I could pursue until I was in a better position. Because when I said I didn't have much money, I mean, I didn't have any money. So I was the first person in my family to go to college, you know, and I was just trying to get a foothold in getting out of the kind of environment I grew up in, which I don't want to pretend was too oppressive, but it was, you know, very lower middle class, and I didn't have a lot of things other people, you know, growing up in slightly more established households would take for granted. And I wanted to kind of escape that a little bit, if that's not too strong a word. And like I said, I was the first person in my family to go to college. I wanted to, you know, have some sort of a career, establish myself a little bit. And always, though, throughout this, I thought eventually I would take a shot at writing, because it was something that really interested me. But like I said, the pay for a writer just starting out was not that attractive. So I had kind of an idea that, well, you know, if I do interesting things, you know, it was really old school, even though I didn't know it. If I just do interesting things, I'll have interesting things and perspectives to write about. And that's the way it used to be. That's the way, you know, writers in the early 20th century really were created, was through living interesting lives. It was only toward the 50s and 60s that there was a transition toward college education for writers, and more English majors and literature majors, creative writing majors were being produced as writers. And they started gradually supplanting those who, you know, came from the school of hard knocks, which you can kind of trace it if you look through the way literature evolved in the 20th century, where it went much more into an imagist school and much less based upon, you know, individual adventures in exotic places, and much more introspective. And then there's been a resurgence, you know, of thrillers later on, I think, because people realize they really like those thrillers. So it's kind of been a blend somewhat. But I, the whole time, thought, well, you know, I got to have something interesting to write about. And frankly, at the time, I didn't think I had a whole lot in my life as a, you know, 18, 19-year-old college kid to where I could speak with any authority, you know, about anything. So I thought, this is a good way. I'll go to the military. I'll learn about the military. I'll learn about, I was an OSI agent. I'll learn about law enforcement. Then I went to law school, and I thought, well, this is great. I'll learn, you know, about how things really go. Because this was around the time that a few years after John Grisham had exploded, you know, with the legal thriller. Before that, you had Perry Mason. Those were more courtroom dramas. But, you know, Grisham came out with The Firm, and that was a big, big, big hit. And that was a legal thriller, which had the law as kind of a setting. You know, and that probably influenced me a lot, thinking that law school would be a really good springboard for giving me some kind of street cred when it came to trying to sell something. But then one day I woke up, I was in my 30s, and I was like, you know, I ain't getting younger. I'm going to have to start writing here. I can't just keep saying someday, 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 or I'm going to swerve right by it, miss it. So I started, trying my hand at it. It took a few years to, kind of find my way, but, it was probably a quicker path than some people, or most people, I would even venture. But I got to where I was, published. I was very fortunate. I sold my first novel to a major publishing house, and it, as a horror novel, that is kind of unheard of, at least at the time. It was very unusual. So I've had a few good turn of events here, and you know, I hope to continue on and do a lot better, get a lot bigger audience. But I've had a pretty good run so far.
Well, I'm wondering also how you took all those interesting things that you've done in your life and, you know, weave them into your fiction. I know you also play guitar, and you, I believe you have a short story about, blues, and, just wondering, you know, how you have weaved, you know, these things into,
well, it's,
into your fiction, it, short and long.
Yeah. It's not hard. Because whatever you're familiar with, you have experience with, and even more importantly, what interests you, There are always angles to find. The story you're referring to in the upcoming collection, Moonless Nocturne, is called Shifty Devil Blues. And that was based, or that was inspired just by what I found was very interesting, and that is the enduring mythos surrounding Robert Johnson. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with Robert Johnson, he was an extremely influential blues guitarist, died very young, and not much was known about it. Just enough was known about him to build up the legend. And that was that he was a guy who wanted to play guitar, a young black man in Mississippi, apparently was no good. He disappeared for a couple of years, showed up again, and suddenly he was phenomenal. And he never would tell anybody exactly how, but his songs hinted, many of his songs hinted that he had cut a deal with the devil. And then he died relatively young, and that really captured the imagination of a lot of people out there, and especially because he was so influential with a lot of his early blues playing. I was familiar with that story, as most guitar players are, and just coming across little things about him one day, just had a little something click in my mind about a bit of an homage, you know, to him, something that touches base with his myth, but also something a little different. So it's not hard to find something that will intersect with the areas of expertise or interest or hobbies. You just got to keep your eyes open for them, and they'll pop up out there.
Well, to me, you're writing horror, right? A dark,
yes,
dark sort of horror. And so, and you say that you want it to lead an interesting life. So you're doing all of these things so that you could have something to write about or an influence in your writing. So how did it become horror from legal drama and stuff?
Is this
something we don't talk about? Or is
no, that's a very good question. I wouldn't say I dreaded that question, but it's a very good one, because that's not what I had in mind at the time. I always have been a fan of horror. Since I was a little kid, I was a big fan of horror. And I was certainly not opposed to writing horror at all, but I did not really set out when I was planning or thinking or dreaming of these things about being a horror author. I really wasn't thinking that way. But then when I started writing, when I sat down and said, look, I got to actually do this. I can't just dabble once in a while, you know, for as a hobby on my own. I got to actually start trying to do something here with this. Everything, when I sit down and try to write a story, everything kept coming back to a horror story. I just couldn't seem to escape it. That's where my imagination went. Everything seemed more interesting. Everything seemed more intriguing. Now, here's the strange thing. I don't read nearly as much horror as people would probably think I do. Now, I'm not opposed to reading horror, and I certainly do read my share of it. But most of what I read are what you would consider mainstream commercial thrillers, mysteries, noir, crime fiction. That's most of what I read, with a very healthy dose, you know, peppering of horror in there. But I'm not somebody who just lives and breathes horror all the time. But when I sit down to write, while I certainly like to think I can write a good, solid mystery, a good, solid police procedural or thriller, and I certainly am doing one right now, I'm under contract for one, and I enjoy them, my creative inclinations always seem to look behind the veil a little bit. You know, but to look what is going on the other side of, veneer of reality there. Or if it's even not supernatural in any way, to more of a really twisted, you know, kind of motivation for a character. I just can't totally escape it. Now, I'm more than capable of writing a story or two here or there, or a novel even, and probably a series of novels, but I'll never probably be able to just jettison horror. I just can't see myself doing that, because it interests me too much to explore the dark side of things in an extreme kind of way. You know, here's a counterintuitive point that I would argue. You know, horror fiction gives me an ability to not have to worry about suspending disbelief of the reader as much, which is, like I said, very counterintuitive. And the reason is, once they're sitting down and reading a horror novel, they're already accepting a certain level of suspension of disbelief. So I've already got the reader to a point where I am not having to worry about selling something quite as hard as I might have to in a more real world type of setting, or less fantastic type of setting. So I find that gives me a lot more freedom to kind of have my characters follow whatever kind of path I think is the most interesting. So that is very, I would say intoxicating, but it's certainly inspiring or encouraging to me when I'm writing, that, you know, I've got an audience that is ready, willing, and able to go here because of the genre I'm in. Whereas I might be facing a much more skeptical audience if I'm keeping it more grounded into a mainstream, you know, piece of fiction, which, you know, I'm not opposed to. Most of my reading, like I said, you know, involves that. But I just love that creative freedom, and the challenge of indulging that at the same time I'm also trying to follow the real world rules and make it seem, you know, plausible, credible, believable, and make the characters seem real. So that challenge and that fusion, you know, that's something that I really really enjoy.
Well, speaking of horror, I was just wondering how you found your way into the horror community. I know I originally found the old Shock Lines message board, and then started to go to some conventions and stuff like that. I just wondered how that worked for you.
Yeah, that's a good question too, because I realized that, you know, I just didn't know anything about the publishing industry, and that's something writers really need to do when they're starting out, is learn a little bit about the publishing industry. You don't have to learn the ins and outs of the business itself right away, but you do need to kind of understand how it operates, certainly when it comes to the genre you're interested in. Genre writers can be very cliquish. You know, they can be very insular. They're usually extremely nice. You know, they can be very nice. They can also be, you know, very I don't want to use any adjectives that are going to get me in trouble. They can be very exclusive. They can be snobbish, you know. But it helps to get to know, you know, at least a few people in the genre, and get to see what it is that, you know, that's acceptable, and what is a way of doing things. Where do they submit their stories? You know, where are they getting published? You know, how do they build their readership? How do they, you know, how have they gone about establishing themselves as authors? And that's what I did. I went to, you know, a Horror Writers Association convention. How I ended up going to an HWA convention, it's been, I am really sad to admit, so many years, I don't remember exactly how I got into that, like how I found it or anything. I think somebody who I was poking around, probably on a bulletin board like you were talking about, mentioned it, recommended it. And so I ended up just finding it online, signing up, and going to it. It was in New York. And that was, you know, a while ago. It was probably over 15 years ago. You know, people were nice. The community, you could tell, was somewhat small, somewhat tight-knit, not tiny, wasn't really tiny, but you could tell almost everybody knew everybody. You could tell that. And so I just got to meet some people, you kind of got a feel for it, you know, find out who, you know, where are these people submitting, you know, there are publishers there, editors there, you know, and obviously a slew of writers, and you just start absorbing stuff. And that's what I did. And I started submitting some stories there. I've been very fortunate. I didn't really have to go through a crucible, you know, of rejections for years, things like that. I had one story I submitted, and it was I got a very kind rejection. I think it was from Cemetery Dance. And then my next story that I submitted was accepted to an anthology that was with a major publishing house. So I was very fortunate there. Now, I had had some other stories I'd written in the meantime that I just never submitted anywhere. It was more like, you know, an exercise in trying to develop my writing. But so I was writing, and I started writing more and more. And when I got accepted into that anthology, I thought, well, now at least I have a publishing credential. Then I got more proactive. And I started contacting writers that I had met at, I think I'd gone to maybe two conventions by then. It had been a couple of years from the first one. I started contacting some writers and started suggesting projects, you know, that I'd really like to get involved in a project, you know, and I have an idea for a project kind of thing. And I got a very good reception. And so I ended up doing a project with several other authors, and you know, that got me some more interaction, you know, with authors and other writers and people. And you know, from there, I just kind of built a minimal network of people and knowledge of the genre to where I was able to find an agent. And I had a novel I started working on, and I gave him sample chapters. I met an agent at one of these I was introduced to, and he really liked it. So he took me on, and I finished the novel, and we sold it to Penguin. And so really that's kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe it's not the perfect path for everyone to take, but what you can take away from this is you got to go out and kind of meet people. You're going to be behind the eight ball a little bit if you don't get to know people and listen to their stories, listen to their paths, and put your finger a little bit on some of the pulse of what's going on, so that you know what markets are out there, where to find markets, you know how you go about submitting. There's a lot of disinformation if you just go cold on the internet and read blogs and things. Or misinformation, I should say. They're not intentionally doing it. But there's a lot of things that are semi-true, or they just don't tell the whole story, or they might even be some bad advice. So you got to – if you go to a convention, you probably don't know this, David, you talk to 10 writers, you probably get 3 or 4 different takes on the same question, you know, at least. Absolutely. If not 10. Yep. If not 10, right? So so what you got to do is pick and choose and glean from it, you know, what is useful – what is a useful bit of information from what they're telling you? Or, you know, what is it? What is some useful advice there? And then you kind of forge your own perspective on it, and you know, employ that when you're trying to, you know, get your work placed. Well, look, I have to though say everything is different now because Kindle came out, and you know, with self-publishing now, the entire attitude. Of attitude might not be the right word. The entire value system, you know, that was in a convention just changed, because now when you go to them, the majority of people there are going to be self-published. I first went to a convention, if you had said you were self-published, I'm sure, you know, they would have just turned their nose up at you and moved on to a different conversation. I mean, I didn't, but that's gone. Okay, that's over. Those days are gone now. And here's what's a little interesting. When I first went to those conventions, I can remember so many people when I, you know, meet them, greet them, you know, just say hi in these little mixers or something. First thing they would ask after they learn my name is, oh, so you're published? Are you published? Where are you published? You know, that's the first question. Within 3 years of that, nobody asked that question anymore. Nobody, literally nobody. That's how quickly it changed. So yes, that the landscape has changed considerably since then. But there are still fundamentals that apply. And one of those is you got to get out there and and meet people so you can gather information and form an understanding of how the business works and how you can fit in.
Networking is everything.
Can be, yes, definitely. Yeah.
Well, and I have a feeling because you write such dark books, you have to get your material from somewhere. So probably a lot of these people you meet disappear. But I'm just suggesting this happens. I'm not saying you did anything.
If that's happened, it's just a coincidence.
Well, because I see you as and it's unlike myself, because I see there's a lot of writers that will take from their own experiences, and you are looking for experiences so that you have something to write about or to build off your writing. So you're putting a lot of yourself into each of your books. That's just a given, I would imagine.
Well, I think every writer does that.
Yeah.
But the way you put yourself in a book is probably not the way a layman would interpret that to me. The way I put myself into my books would be through a very intense, immersive exercise of imagining myself in the shoes of a particular type of character. And that means shedding a lot of your own identity, a lot of your own ego. And I don't mean that in the sense of conceit. I mean that in the psychological sense. Shedding it as best we can to really empathize and identify with the character, to where, what would this person do? And the way I try to figure that out is, what would I do if I were that person? And contrary to what a lot of people might think, I don't think people are all that different. I don't think different races and different genders, different orientations, I don't think we're all that different. We have a lot of superficial differences. We may even have a lot of deep value differences and worldview differences, but we're still human beings who function in certain ways. And if you can just adopt the worldview that you would attribute to your character, if you can adopt the identity, I think we can do a very good job of making a compelling approximation of those kinds of characters who are far different, than the author. We're not writing symbolic representations of groups here. We're writing characters. We're writing people, individuals. And there are certain universals that apply to individuals and in their motivations, in their weaknesses, in their foibles. And then it just becomes a matter of how that the character manifests itself through the traits that, might be identified, or through through the lens of the identity of the person, or the lifestyle of the person, or the gender of the person, things like that. Obviously there are differences between men and women, but we're all still people with functioning brains who have certain tendencies to rationalize. We have certain value systems that are almost universal, if not completely universal. We have certain fears, we have certain ways of going about, achieving goals. And so we take these things that are common, and then you start with that, is the way I do it. And then you try to employ your understanding of the differences between you and that person in determining how this character would act in a given situation or speak, or what their motivations would be, or their goals, or how they would go about doing something. So it's an exercise in just, putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, to put it, superficially. But that's how my writing, puts me into it. It's not that, I'm this character and I'm this character. There are very few characters I write that I would say, well, yeah, that's the way I'd look at it, or how I would act. It's instead, that's the way I'd look at it. That's how I would act if I were that person, which is different.
So if we were to come to your place when you were writing, you'd be dressed up like one of your characters. And
No, I'm not a method writer. Oh, okay. I'm not a method writer.
I just wanted to make sure that, you know, we can find you in, like, some dress and doing all this weird stuff on a bed somewhere and, you know, stab
you. Know, not that I'll admit to. You, no. You never catch me.
Never. You'll see on the street. No, but isn't there a certain amount of when you share your feelings, but isn't that a vulnerability that you kind of expose yourself by doing that? And that when you put the book out there, then you know, so you kind of have to you know, sit and wait and see how people respond.
Oh, absolutely. Look, pick look, up,
you know,
we writers are the neediest people out there, okay? We, no matter who the writer is, there are two types. There are one who will agree with me and liars, okay? And David, you can vouch for me here. We are needy people, okay? We put this thing out there. We want certainly to entertain.
Yep.
Okay, we do. We want to perhaps, you know, make a point kind of create a world. We want to do those things. But more than anything else, we want people to like our product, our art. We want to impress people with our story, with our storytelling, because if we do our job, they'll be impressed. If we do it right, they'll be impressed. So it's not just out of ego or conceit, even though that's a huge part of a writer, let's be honest. But it's because we know then we've done a good job, and we want so much to know that we've done a good job. Because really, why else would we spend all this time sitting, you know, in front of a laptop or in front of a PC or, you know, in the old days at a typewriter, pouring ourselves out like this? You know, for money, it's not, you know, very few writers make the kind of money that would justify spending, you know, so much of your life that way. No, it's much more primal than that. It's the need to have somebody see some side of you that is not apparent, some side that you don't show, that you don't live, some side that you're pouring into a creation here, and for them to approve of it, and you can have that sense of accomplishment that you did it, you did what you set out to do, and you did it well. So we're really, really needy people. I think it was Dorothy Parker who said, "Oh, writing's easy. You just sit down in front of a typewriter and open a vein." You know, and that's true. You know, it's true, because you really do pour part of yourself into it there. If nothing else, the amount of effort that good writing takes is extremely daunting. Extremely. Because you have to do it continuously, repeatedly, day after day after day, if you're writing a novel. And even if you're writing a short story, you have to spend a lot of time, you know, even on a, let's say, a 5,000 word short story that I could write, you know, in a few days, I spend a lot of time with that story, thinking about it, certainly writing it, rewriting it, recrafting it, turning it over in my head, turning over plot points, character issues, words, sentences. It's an immersive process, and you have to love it, and you have to need it, and we need it. We need to do this. We need to try to make sense of the drive we have in ourselves to tell a story. And the only way you can make sense of it is to actually tell those stories. So, yeah, it's an exercise in vulnerability in a lot of ways, because you have to have both a thick skin, because of, you know, the likelihood of rejection is high. But you also have to understand and recognize why you're doing it, so that you can know what to expect. And that is a lot of uncertainty and doubt. And you know, I never, ever think.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
That a story I wrote is great. Sometimes I think a story I wrote is good. Sometimes. But a lot of times I have no idea, and it tends to be the ones where I have no idea that people are the most complimentary of. So it's a very strange avocation, let me tell you. but yes, it's we're needy people. I mean, David's being conspicuously quiet here. He may not want to.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. You bleed on the page and you put it out there and. It can be scary at times.
And the reason I'm stressing that we're needy people is so that other writers, maybe new writers or aspiring writers out there, will understand that it's okay to be needy. And also, if you recognize it, you can kind of control it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can restrain it a little bit so that you're not a pain in the arse, you know, to your beta readers or your editors, you know, where you're constantly fishing for validation. You know, it's like you just understand, look, this is natural that I feel this way. It's natural that I have these anxieties over my writing. Mm. And that makes it easier. Once you understand that it's a normal part of the process, you can deal with it a lot more easily. You're a lot more readily. You become, you still have that need, but you don't really need to slake it. You know, you can just let it be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I wanted to go back. You know, we were talking about point of view and we were talking about going into the shoes of your character. I just thought it was really interesting that you have a story in Moonless Nocturne that's going to be coming out called Household, where
you take
the point of view of the house and you step into the view of the house. I just thought it was a fascinating take on a story.
I will confess that I am very proud of that story. And I'll tell you what. The reason I'm proud of that story, beyond hopefully you find it well written, hopefully you find it very entertaining and exciting and scary, kinetic, moving you along reading. I hope it does everything a story should do. But the thing that I'm most proud of is I think that I came up with a pretty original premise for a story.
Mm, absolutely.
And if not in the concept than in the presentation of it, because for your listeners out there, Household is a haunted house story basically told from the point of view of the house. And that's exactly how I sat down to write. I sat down to write a haunted house story from the point of view of the house. And that, presented some challenges, but I was so intrigued or inspired by that idea that I was able to put a lot of creative energy into figuring out how to do that. And I like the end result of that story. And that was one of the ones that I thought, oh, this is a good story. And I got some, my early readers were like really impressed. You know, my first reader, my wife, she's like, that's the best story you've ever written, I've gotten very good response from that story. It's the kind of reception that I was hoping for. I hit the mark with it. So your question, I think, went to, how do you do something when you're trying to identify with a character? How do you identify with a house? I don't want to do any spoilers in the story, but the way I identified with the house was, the idea that a house takes its energy from its occupants and kind of it kind of gives it, brings a personality into being, is the idea. Yeah. So it was the same kind of exercise. Just, okay, if I were a house and I had I was conscious, I was sentient somehow as a house and I drew my energy and my ability to think through the energy I feed off of from the occupants, what would that be like? And that's really how I approached it.
That's very interesting. You know,
I don't want to go into any spoilers, but I think that after readers finish that story, they'll see exactly, you know, how I formulated it in my head.
Well, you certainly sound mentally healthy, so not a problem. Where do you create? Where do the stories come from? Like,
you know, that's a question I've been asked so many times, and it's, you know, at first I'm gonna confess another thing. I was very dismissive of that question when I was starting out writing. When I first got published and I was first doing interviews, I was a bit snobby about when it came to that question. I have to admit, and I was wrong in being so, because what I realized over the years was that that's a sincere question. Okay, that's not the throwaway question I used to think it was. That's a sincere question, because a lot of people don't know. And I kind of assumed everybody knew, and they're throwing it out there for me to just talk about it. And I guess, and that's where I was wrong. And so I'm glad you asked it, to be honest, because there's a guy I know named Fred, and I pay him $100 per idea. And that's where he gives me, no, I'm just kidding.
That's what, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. No.
Idea okay, factories.
here's the answer to that question. It is not inspiration as much as it's perspiration. Okay. It's a process. And if you can hone your process, if you can kind of come up first with the process and then refine it, you're not going to have a problem coming up with story ideas. If you wait for lightning bolts of inspiration, if you wait for a muse to come and visit you, you're going to do a lot of waiting. That's just not the way it works. Not for me. Maybe for some people. I can't completely dismiss that possibility. But I doubt it. I think what it is a writer who, you know, seems to have a lot of imaginative juices flowing all the time, what they're really doing is they understand how their brain creates these things, and they just employ the process that their brain needs to do it. So, okay, I'm talking, you know, in descriptive terms instead of explaining what that process is. Well, the process is usually something like this. I find something, a kernel of something interesting, something that could capture my imagination. It could be a setting. It could be a plot point or a twist. It could be a character, which is usually what it is, or it can be a situation. And once I have something, I think, wouldn't that be interesting? And the way you do that is like when something captures your eye or you hear something and it perks your attention real quick, you think, what if X, Y, and Z? And from there, I take what would be the basis for a useful premise for a story. This is how I think of it, a useful premise. And I twist and tease and start looking at it from different directions, like a sort of like a Necker cube. If people know what a Necker cube is, it's that pencil drawing of a cube that looks like it's facing one way until you look at it slightly differently and suddenly you realize it's facing the other way. I kind of try to do that with a premise and look at it from different directions to see what could I do with this that's a little different, and start asking lots of questions. Well, what if this? What if that? A lot of it's trial and error. But once I got in my head a decent grasp of what that premise, or how I'd like to use that premise. Doesn't not a complete story by any means, not even a complete plot, just a decent grasp of it. I'll sit down and I'll try to write a scene to start. I almost always, almost not, there's very few times I could say always, but almost always, I sit down and write the first opening paragraph, or the first opening scene without really having much of any idea where the story's going to go. And I take that opening paragraph or opening scene, opening description, and I use that now to build a story around. I sit back and I think, okay, where does this story want to go from here? And then I try to plot it out. One of the beauties of short fiction, one of the beauties of short stories is you are much freer to write organically than with a novel. Mm-hmm. I have to take a different approach with a novel. A novel needs to be plotted out because it is a long exercise in discipline. And if you write by the seat of your pants, so to speak, it's going to meander and wander. And I can tell when a writer does that. When I'm reading a novel, I can tell, and I'm very confident I'm pretty much always going to be correct, whether or not they outlined it all or whether or not they just pantsed it. I can tell because of the way it travels from scene to scene. It doesn't have much direction. And then suddenly it'll realize two-thirds, three-quarters, four-fifths of the way through where it wants to go, and then it'll just suddenly take off toward that spot. I am not the kind who can sit down and outline an entire story very well. I just feel too constricted, too constrained, and I would spend way too much time altering the outline, you know, as opposed to just writing the story. But I do, when I'm writing a novel, need to come up with a plot line and what I would call milestones, which if you think of it like a map, if you're driving from, you know, we'll say from Florida to California, you know the direction you're going. You know your destination. You don't know every single highway you're going to take, you know, every exit you're going to take. You just know, okay, I'm going to go from Florida here. I'm going to reach New Orleans. Then I'm going to go through Dallas. I'm going to go through Phoenix, maybe. And then I'm going to end up in LA. So those, you know, you have these milestones along the way. So you know the general direction you're heading, but you haven't restricted yourself to a certain set of streets or highways. You're free to kind of just head in that direction. And that's the way I kind of handle it. So I know where I'm going. I just don't necessarily know the routes, each of the routes I'm going to take to get there. With a short story, though, the beauty of it is it lets you indulge in some more organic writing, which I think most writers really prefer. That most writers, if they had their druthers, they would just write organically. That's where you just sit down and write whatever comes into your head. Problem is, sitting down and writing whatever comes into your head is not a very effective way to be a good writer. But with a short story, you can come closer to that. You can approximate that. I would say it's probably not wise to just write organically as a pure, you know, matter. You don't want to be just somebody who sits there and pantses it. But you have that light at the end of the tunnel from the moment you write the first word, really, in a lot of ways. You have a set manageable distance to travel here. And so it lets me not have to worry about ripple effects and consequences as much as I do with a novel. So I feel a lot more organic when I'm writing it. Now, I still pretty much know where the story's going to go. Like I said, I'll write the opening paragraph or an opening scene just so I can really feel the character, so I can get a sense of the characters and who they are. And then I can get a more concrete idea of what this story is going to do or what I want to do with it and where it's going to go. And then I can write the rest of it. But I don't really need an outline to do that with a short story.
You're missing whereabouts you took the drugs.
I thought everybody knew that.
Well, yeah, but I was like what part of the process do you take the drugs in?
I think it'd be easier to say what part of the process don't I take the drugs.
The drugs, right.
Stephen King had a very interesting revelation about his drug use. I thought, what if you read his on writing, he said, you know, he admits that, you know, he used to really coke out a lot and drink a lot of beer while he was doing it. And, you know, he rationalized that it was because he's an artist and he's so sensitive and there's so much pressure when you're so aware of the world around you, you know, that he needs to do this to function and maintain his level of creativity in the face of so much, you know, so much real world misery. It was all, and he admits it was all BS. It was just a way to rationalize, you know, doing drugs. And he said that you don't need any of that. You don't need any of that to be creative. it's an escape from having to actually work. Instead, you're just kind of trying to have the drugs let your mind run free without having to really use your own brain power to do it. And he said he doesn't have to do it anymore. He never had to do it. It was just easier. And it numbed him up and, you know, gave him that feel good high. But I never, you know, indulged in that kind of thing. I'll tell you exactly why. Because you know, my youth, I saw lots of kids getting busted and arrested and kicked out of school and things for drugs. And I didn't have, you know, I told you I came from a very lower middle class family. Neither of my parents even graduated from high school. My stepfather graduated from vocational tech, I think, after he dropped out. But I didn't have anybody to rely on except myself and my brain. And I knew, one, if I got in trouble and, you know, with the law and had a criminal record or something, well, that wasn't going to make things easier for me. And two, if the only thing I had to rely on was my brain, I certainly did not want to screw up my brain. So I really stayed away from that stuff.
Yeah, that's too bad.
So, I know. I'm sorry if that lets people down. You know, makes me boring or something. No, I had other vices. Drugs weren't one of them.
Now, with American Nocturne, you have a fully sanctioned, licensed, however you want to state it, Kolchak Night Stalker story. And for people who don't know, that's like a supernatural and science fiction show from the early 70s. How did that all come about?
Yes. Well, Kolchak the Night Stalker, when I was a little kid, that show probably influenced me more than anything. I was a really young kid, and that show came on mid to late 70s. And it had been a TV movie, and a lot of people don't remember this, but at the time, that was it was called The Night Stalker. That was the highest rated TV movie ever, and it held that record for decades. I mean, it was big. It was a big TV movie called The Night Stalker, and they made a sequel that was not as watched called The Night Strangler, but then they made a series out of it. And the series was called Kolchak, who was the main character, The Night Stalker, and the main character was a reporter who just had this knack of stumbling. He was kind of a bumbling reporter for a low-level news service, but he kept having this eye and ear for supernatural stuff or going on, and he would always stumble across them. And I just loved that show. I mean, I absolutely loved it when I was a little kid. It just struck the right chord. It showed me the potential of horror, you know, to be so entertaining, because I was already interested in, you know, the universal horror movies. You know, I loved all those things. And when this came on, I was a little kid, really little kid. I was just in love with it. Didn't last very long, but I never forgot that show. It kind of developed a bit of a cult following, and a lot of people from my era have cited that show as an inspiration. For example, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he cites that as being an inspiration for him to come up with Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Supernatural. Mm. There are a lot of X-Files. TV shows. X-Files, definitely. Definitely. They even tried to do a crossover at some point, I read, and it just didn't work. But with Darren McGavin on there, if you remember, there were some X-Files episodes where Darren McGavin, who played Kolchak, for anybody who doesn't know, in the series, he came on, but they instead made him a retired FBI agent. They were going to make him be Kolchak, but they couldn't work it out, I guess, with the rights. Mm. Which brings me to your question. How did I write a sanctioned, as you put it, you know, authorized Kolchak story? Well, it's interesting. The ABC has owned the theatrical rights to Kolchak, the Night Stalker, but the author, Jeff Rice, of the book that it was based on, which was an unpublished novel, and his agent said, you know, this would probably make a better movie. And he sold the rights to it as a movie. And Richard Matheson, by the way, wrote the screenplay. And only later, after the movie, did they actually publish the novel. But he got into a lawsuit with them, apparently, after Kolchak came out. And the way it was resolved is ABC kept the theatrical rights. He kept the literary rights. So there were some Coal Shack things over the years, it developed kind of a cult following, you know, a hardcore, you know, horror people who remembered it really loved it. And it had, it's very campy, you know, it had a, had a pretty good following for a show that was such a short run. And there was a comic book that came out, that Moonstone puts, I think they may still put out, Coal Shack comic books. Then there was a Coal Shack anthology I heard about. So I wrote this story to submit it to a Coal Shack anthology. The problem is, by the time I got done writing the story, it was long. It was a pretty long story. It would not qualify as a short story. And they were looking for really short pieces. And so they apparently liked it a lot, but they said, this is too long. So I just held on to that story. And when American Nocturne was, when I was putting together American Nocturne, I made a few inquiries and calls and tracked down the author. His name was Jeff Rice. And I got somebody to ask him if I could have permission, you know, to write a Coal Shack story. And he graciously agreed. And I even convinced my publisher to pay him an honorarium, you know, for it, because I didn't want to just, you know, take his intellectual property, you know, without giving something for it. And the publisher was happy. They loved the story. The publisher, original publisher, American Nocturne, loved it. So they said, yeah, they paid him one. And so they actually gave me a check to give to him. And so I got his address and I mailed the check. And while the check was in the mail to him, he passed away. Mm. And so it was very sad, but I eventually got the thing back in the mail and I found out he had died. So I got in touch with the person who had contacted him, and he said all the rights to the Coal Shack Literary Estate there are going to his son. And he said, I'll contact his son for you and see what his son says. And his son said, that's fine. Go ahead. You know, go ahead and publish it. You know, I'm sure my father would have liked it. So we just gave him the check, son, and for letting us use it, and thanked him profusely. And then it appeared in American Nocturne. And that is a story I get lots of compliments on. People really, really appreciated having that story in there. They said it, not only for the nostalgia, you know, but for the way I captured, they thought, you know, the energy of the show and the spirit of the characters, and which doesn't shock me because I really was strongly influenced by that show. So it was not a hard story to write for me. It was kind of like going home, you know, it was very familiar feeling. So yeah, it's going to be in, it's still in American Nocturne. It's going to be in the re-release here coming up. And it's called A Murmur of Evil. That was one of the most fun stories to write. I really enjoyed writing that story. And, you know, I hate to sound like a downer, but writing is not often fun. It's not, and I'm sure David, you'd agree. It's work. Oh,
absolutely. It's tough.
You know, when I teach sometimes classes at conventions now, you know, little writing seminars, things like that, I always tell the students there, they're usually aspiring young writers who just try to get into it, that writing is two things. It's work and it's habit. And you can't really ignore the work part. It's work. It's a lot of rewriting and concentration and focus. You got to put a lot of hours into it.
Absolutely.
And just to explain what that means about habit too. When I was in creative writing college, when I took a creative writing class, I remember the instructor, one of the things he hit into us was that writing was work. That was his thing. Writing is work. What I realized as I got into it years later, that is only half correct, because you can work really hard. You can work your fingers to the bone, but unless you have it as a habit, you're probably not going to get where you want to go. You're probably not going to get not nearly have as much productivity. And that's because what a lot of people will do, they'll write on weekends or something like that, and they'll write for hours. You can only write for so long before your brain's numb, you know, and it's probably a lot shorter than people think. You know, you write for 3 or 4 hours, some people a little longer, maybe some people shorter, but you're going to start really having diminishing returns after the first, you know, few hours. And people will do that. They'll write, oh, I'm going to write all day Sunday or something like, well, that's a lot of work. But you don't have a habit if you're doing that. The habit needs to be a daily routine and regimen. You need to live and breathe that story. Doesn't mean you can't go on with your normal life. Doesn't mean you can't, you know, engage in your day-to-day activities and you have to do nothing but write. But it means you never can really let go of that piece you're working on completely. It's always got to be a little bit of a companion, and you definitely need to take it for a walk every day. Just think of it like a pet, you know. You got to feed it and take it for a walk every day or it's going to die. So that's why I tell students that writing is work and it's habit. And the work in writing is rewriting. I mean, that's the real work. Every piece of good fiction you know, has to be rewritten extensively from the first draft, I think. Because the first draft, you're kind of telling the story. You're kind of creating the story. You know, you're in a way you're like telling the story. I think somebody once said the first draft, you're telling a story to yourself. And there's a lot of truth to that description. The future drafts are you're molding it to tell that story to other people. And that's a completely different matter. So, you know, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially when you've got a habit. You asked for that one. Well, listen, we're quickly running out of time. So tell us about what you've got going on, your newest releases and what we can expect from Hank.
Yes. Well, I've got American Nocturne, as a collection that was released about 5 years ago, is being re-released under the Baskerville imprint of 25 and Y, great publishing house. They're really treating me well. That re-release is coming up probably next month. It's going to be released. That was nominated for a Bram Stoker Award. And then in October 1st, that's kind of a lead-in to my new collection that's coming out, American Nocturne Volume 2, pretty much. It's called Moonless Nocturne. And that is scheduled for release October 1st. 25 and Y, that's going to be under Esker and Riddle, the imprint. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be I won't say a big deal, but they are very excited about it. So it's going to be something they're going to be getting behind, I think, a lot. That's going to be coming out October 1st. I've also got a reprint of my third Jake Hatcher novel. My first two novels are still in print. They're with Penguin. The first one was Damnable. That's the one you mentioned earlier, when the Bram Stoker. The sequel to that is Diabolical. The third in the series is The Angel of the Abyss. And that is being re-released soon also from Baskerville Press. Although I think American Nocturne, no, correct myself. I think that's going to be with Esker and Riddle also. But The Angel of the Abyss, I think, is going to be with Baskerville Press. And that is third in the series. And I've got a contract for a fourth novel in that series called The Emperor of Shadows. But before I can write that, I've got to finish the novel that I have under contract right now with them called Darwin's Laws. And that is I would call that a mainstream thriller. It's not a horror novel. And so I got a lot of things going on right now, you know, a lot of irons in the fire, so to speak. But the big one coming up right now is the re-release of American Nocturne, which is leading up to the October 1st release of Moonless Nocturne.
Wow. Now, you also have a website for people to come find you and send you their love mail?
Yes, I do. It is being reconstructed right now by my publisher and updated. Hopefully by the time people go to it, it will be up and running. But yes, it's just hankschwabel.com. And that should have, you know, my covers and, you know, click-throughs and, you know, anything people would like to know further about me or my stuff. But yes, hankschwabel.com. And we'll definitely have that up soon. They took it down to reconstruct it and update it for these new publications coming out.
Yeah, we'll have that linked as well and to our site so people can find it with one click, you know, and so it'll have your Tinder and Grindr and phone number. Now. I mean, that's really important nowadays.
You're really determined to have my worlds collide here, aren't you?
It's all about the fun, you know. You want these experiences to write really good books, so I'm the one to give it. Now you also have a giveaway for some of our listeners.
We do. My publisher is graciously offered to give your listeners an opportunity to get a discount on pre-orders. So if they want to go to a link we'll be providing there on your website, they can click through and get a 20% discount on pre-orders. Those will be signed, those pre-orders. So signed by me. Okay. Yes. And somebody along the way.
I'm just like, don't let Dave sign them.
No, we'd have to pay them, right?
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
those will be signed copies, and they get them at a 20% discount. It'll be available as either a hardcover or trade paperback on their choice. We have 10 pre-orders we are willing to give away here to your listeners in whatever method you wanted to establish. I think you said the first 10 emails.
Yeah.
And we have 10 ARCs of Moonless Nocturne. An ARC, for people who may not know, is an advanced review copy. So we'll have the pre-order winners, the first 10 to get a free pre-order for American Nocturne. And then we have ARCs ready to go. So we'll have up to 10 ARCs that my publisher will mail out to whoever is lucky enough to win on your website. However you want to set that up is fine with us. We just want to do something nice for your listeners and tell them we appreciate them tuning in.
Yeah, it's a good thing because they know I don't do anything nice for them. I'm the mean one. So, wow, it's been a very, very conversation, and you are very, very good speaker. You have lots to say, and it's very interesting. And we learned a lot here today, you know.
Well, thank you for saying so. Some might say I bloviate, but, I like to think I just filled dead air.
It's good. We learned a lot. We learned that Hank likes to do a lot of drugs during his writing process. Mm-hmm. Pretends he's a house and he's a character, and don't knock on the door. He might be dressed up like someone you read.
You know, I'm so drunk when I do them, I really don't know what I'm putting in my system.
Yeah, I see, and that's important. That's a, you're a good inspiration for young writers.
Well, I try to be a model for the next dysfunctional generation.
Boy, I tell you, you are the one. Well, fantastic. We'll have all this up, and we'll have to follow up with this guy. Our guest has been the great Hank Schwebel.
Thank you for having me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Have been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.